Well, if George Bush were to be judged by the standards of the Nuremberg tribunals, he'd be hanged. So too, mind you, would every single American president since the end of the Second World War, including Jimmy Carter. The suggestion comes from perhaps the most feted liberal intellectual in the world, the American linguist Noam Chomsky. His latest attack on the way his country behaves in the world is called Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. I met him at the British Museum today, where we talked in the Assyrian galleries. I asked him whether he was suggesting there was nothing new in the so-called Bush Doctrine.
Well, it depends. I mean, it's recognized to be revolutionary. Henry Kissinger, for example, described it as a revolutionary new doctrine, which tears to shreds the Westphalian system, the 17th century system of international order, and, of course, the UN Charter. But nevertheless, and it has been very widely criticized within the foreign policy elite, but on narrow grounds, the doctrine is not really new. It's extreme.
But what was the United States supposed to do after 9/11? It had been the victim of a grotesque, intentional attack. What was it supposed to do?
But why pick 9/11? Why not pick 1993? Actually, the fact that the terrorist act succeeded in September 11th did not alter the risk analysis. In 1993, similar groups, U.S. trained jihadis, came very close to blowing up the World Trade Center. With better planning, they probably would have killed tens of thousands of people. Since then, it was known that this is very likely. In fact, right through the 90s, there's technical literature predicting it. And we know what to do. What you do is police work. Police work is the way to stop terrorist acts. So, and it's succeeded.
But you're suggesting the United States, in that sense, is the author of its own nemesis.
Well, first of all, this is not my opinion. It's the opinion of just about every specialist on terrorism. Take a look, say, at Jason Burke's recent book on Al-Qaeda, which is the best book there is. What he points out is he runs through the record of how each act of violence has increased recruitment, financing, mobilization. And what he says is, I'm quoting him, that each act of violence is a small victory for bin Laden.
But why do you imagine that George Bush behaves like this?
Because I don't think they care that much about terror. In fact, we know that. Take, say, the invasion of Iraq. It was predicted by just about every specialist, by intelligence agencies, that the invasion of Iraq would increase the threat of Al-Qaeda-style terror, which is exactly what happened. The point is that...
Well, then why would he do it?
Because invading Iraq has value in itself. I mean, establishing...
Well, what value?
What value? Establishing the first secure military base in a dependent client state at the heart of the energy-producing region of the world.
Don't you even think that the people of Iraq are better off having got rid of a dictator?
They got rid of two brutal regimes, one that we're supposed to talk about and one we're not supposed to talk about. The two brutal regimes were Saddam Hussein's and the U.S.-British sanctions, which were devastating to society, had killed hundreds of thousands of people, were forcing people to be reliant on Saddam Hussein. Now, the sanctions could obviously have been turned to weapons rather than destroying the society without an invasion. And if that had happened, it's not at all impossible that the people of Iraq would have sent Saddam Hussein the same way, to the same fate as other monsters supported by the U.S. and Britain. Ceausescu, Suharto, Duvalier, Marcos, a long list of them. In fact, the people, the Westerners who know Iraq best, we're predicting this all along.
You seem to be suggesting this, or implying, perhaps I'm being unfair to you, but you seem to be implying there's some kind of moral equivalence between democratically elected heads of state like George Bush, or prime ministers like Tony Blair, and regimes in places like Iraq.
The term moral equivalence is an interesting one. It was invented, I think, by Jean Kirkpatrick as a method of trying to prevent criticism of foreign policy and state decisions. It has a meaningless notion. There's no moral equivalence whatsoever.
Is a good thing if it is preferable for an individual to live in a liberal democracy? Is there benefit to be gained by spreading the values of that democracy, however you can?
Reminds me of the question that Gandhi was once asked about Western civilization. What did he think of it? He said, yeah, it would be a good idea. And in fact, it would be a good idea to spread the values of liberal democracy. But that's not what the U.S. and Britain are trying to do. It's not what they've done in the past. I mean, take a look at the regions under their domination. They don't spread liberal democracy. What they spread is dependence and subordination. Furthermore, it's well known that those are a large part of the reason for the great opposition to U.S. policy within the Middle East. In fact, this was known back in the 1950s.
But there's a whole slew of countries in Eastern Europe right now that would say, we are better off now than we were when we were living under the Soviet
empire,
as a consequence of how the West behaved.
And there's a lot of countries in U.S. domains, like Central America and the Caribbean, who wish that they could be free of American domination. I mean, we don't pay much attention to what happens there, but they do. But look, I mean, just in the 1980s, when the current incumbents were in their Reaganite phase, hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered in Central America. The U.S. carried out a massive terrorist attack against Nicaragua. It was mainly a war on the church. They killed the assassinated an archbishop and murdered six leading Jesuit intellectuals. This is in El Salvador. It was a monstrous period. What did they impose? Was it liberal democracies? No.
You've mentioned on two or three occasions this relationship between the United States and Britain. Do you understand why Tony Blair behaved as he did over Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, if you look at the British diplomatic history, back in the 1940s, Britain had to make a decision. I mean, Britain had been the major world power, actually. The United States, though by far the richest country in the world, was not a major actor in the global scene, except regionally. By the Second World War, it was obvious the U.S. was going to be the world dominant power. Everyone knew that. Britain had to make a choice. Was it going to be part of what would ultimately be a Europe that might move towards independence? Or would it be what the Foreign Office called a junior partner to the United States? Well, it essentially made that choice to be a junior partner to the United States. U.S. leaders have no illusions about this. So during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, you look at the declassified record, they treated Britain with total contempt. Harold Macmillan wasn't even informed of what was going on. And Britain's existence was at stake. You know, it's quite dangerous. And one high official, probably Dean Atchison, and he's not identified, described Britain as, in his words, our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner. Well, the British would like to hear the fashionable word, but the masters use the actual word. Those are choices Britain has to make. I mean, why Blair decided, I couldn't say.
Chomsky, thank you.